And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined, as always, by Stuart Mandel. Stu, before we get to talking about some football, let's talk about what we like to eat during football games. The Super Bowl just happened last weekend, and any game-watching event, whether it's the XFL or college football, my go-to is a Trader Joe's staple, and that is the sweet potato tortilla chips. Have you had them yet?
I'll be honest, I didn't even know that sweet potato tortilla chips were a thing, but you're saying I can get them at Trader Joe's.
Yeah, the sweet and the salty aspect is big. I wasn't going in there looking for it. I kind of stumbled upon them. I'm like, let me try this. And they're really, really good. It's pretty much the only snack food that I think I eat, at least in terms of chips now. I would highly recommend you trying them.
I will. So we had the Super Bowl over the weekend, and then it very quickly turned into an eventful week in college football. Wednesday was signing day. We're going to get into that a little bit later. But before that, obviously the big, big news Tuesday, Mark D'Antonio retiring as Michigan State's coach right before signing day. We wanted to bring on our guest, Nick Baumgartner. He covers both Michigan State and Michigan for The Athletic. He's following the coaching search as we speak. So let's bring him on.
And now we're joined by our guest. He is Nick Baumgartner. He's a senior writer and columnist for the Athletic's Detroit site. He is all over Michigan, has been for a long time, as well as Michigan State and the Lions. Nick, thanks for joining us on the Audible today.
Yeah, guys, no problem.
All right, so let's start. Obviously, huge news right before signing day. Mark D'Antonio, there's been some rumblings for about the last 6 months about this possibly happening, but the timing, I think, really kind of stuns some people that it went down the way it did. And I think, and we're going to get into a little bit more about what his legacy actually is at Michigan State, but what was your reaction to when you heard it, and what did you... You know, how do you think people should view the timing of this?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think that there, you know, I haven't talked to people yesterday. You know, there were some at Michigan State that were totally caught off guard on Tuesday when the announcement was made. But at the same time, you know, those people weren't, so, you know, like shocked, because I think a lot of people at Michigan State in the higher level had known for several weeks, or maybe more than a month, that this was certainly possible. And like you said, Bruce, I mean, this is something that's been talked about, you know, behind the scenes for more than almost a year, I would say, at least, and maybe even longer. I mean, you know, Michigan State's had so many issues off the field that have just lingered. And, you know, the institution, the administration, everybody has sort of tried to, you know, talk around it, I guess is the best way I can say it, and act like it's not happening. And it just always felt like, you know, these issues, this lawsuit that they're still involved with and everything else, the longer they continued on, the more difficult it was going to be for this to continue. And then, of course, the downtick in performance on the field, you know, sort of amplifies that. So, you know, I wasn't shocked. This was probably the least shocked I've been of these like sudden announcements. The timing was weird. And that was, you know, there's been reports that have come out in recent days and over the last week and a half or so about, you know, further allegations from that lawsuit from Curtis Blackwell, the former staffer here. So, you know, he said that had nothing to do with it. But, I mean, we can look at this, you know, with logic and say there's no way that had no impact on it. And I assume that a lot of folks will look at it that way. And they'll also look at that money, you know, the $4.3 million that he got on January 15th. You know, it was avoidable. The bad timing was avoidable. And I think that that's what everybody sort of took away from it.
He said, Nick, that you know, he started with a kind of an open letter at his press conference, and he said he'd been working on it for over a week as he was on airplanes. Well, he was on airplanes because he was out recruiting. And I guess that makes
correct.
That leads to the logical question. If he knew he was going to retire, why did he continue to go on recruiting players to Michigan State?
Yeah, right. That's why it makes no sense. I mean, it's one of these things where he tried to say it as, you know, as I was doing this, I was, you know, going through the process of asking myself, you know, am I prepared to commit to these kids for the next 3 or 4 years? And then eventually, you know, it's, you know, I decided I wasn't. And, you know, that I guess he could maybe claim he writes this letter as he's coming back from his last recruiting visit, if he wants, and you know, in that sense. But at the same time, it seems very convenient on some of these things, which has become kind of, you know, what these coaches do over the years in terms of their time frame. There's just no way there's something over the last 30 days that, you know, or maybe longer. I have no doubt, guys, that he was contemplating this. We all know he was contemplating this. But the timing of it, just with the fact that he received that bonus payment. I mean, I said the other day, I was like, you know, if he had resigned or retired the day after that bonus came in, would that look any worse than doing it the day before signing day? I would say probably not. It would be about the same. It would look bad no matter what. So, you know, that's the thing I think that really is kind of ridiculous here, is that this could have been done in December. This could have been done in September. You know, if he wanted to, he could have negotiated his severance and whatever else, and it would have been, you know, whatever, and they would have had to jump on it. But he didn't, because, you know, you have to wonder, did he want to still keep coaching? And, you know, things had got to a point with the off the field stuff where it was just, you can't keep going here. Or was it truly burnout, or was it both? You know, I mean, I think it may be a factor, you know, all factors, I guess, may be considered there.
Nick, Stu and I had this conversation a little bit yesterday on Wednesday. After D'Antonio's press conference the day before, I think Stu had tweeted out something about something that D'Antonio had said at the podium, mm-hmm. kind of struck a chord similar, he thought, to Chris Peterson. And my reaction to that was, I didn't see it at all that way, whereas I was like, maybe some of the sentiment about just not enjoying it and being worn down was there. But when I heard Chris Peterson talk, whatever it was, you know, a month ago, I mm-hmm. felt like here was a guy who was like, all right, there's a lot of other stuff out there in life. I want to see what's out there, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I felt like Chris Peterson was kind of running to something where I felt like, you know, use the word, you know, burned out or worn mm-hmm. down. And even when he said, if you're 50-50, this is not the profession to be 50-50 about it. You got to be 100%. You know, saying all that, if he was, you know, the last 4 years pretty much they've been slightly better than 500. It feels like the gap between them and the top of the division. Yeah. Ohio State is recruiting at a ridiculously high level. James Franklin and Penn State have kicked into a different level than they were, you know, 4 years ago. And even Jim Harbaugh, mm-hmm. it's not like they've been a disaster. They just haven't been able to to overcome Ohio State. So do you think it was just a frustration as much as anything? Or what do you think? Because he's by nature, it seems like, we all know D'Antonio a little bit and have been around him.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, his default expression looks to be exacerbated, even if he may not.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah,
so exactly. What was your read on it behind the scenes?
I think it's a true, maybe a combination of really everything. Because I think for years we've sort of around here been working under the, you know, sort of assumption, or maybe even not an assumption, but, you know, the fact that D'Antonio was probably not going to be a coach that just hung on forever. I think that we all, you know, I think family pull, I think it was going to be tough for him to leave no matter what, but I think, you know, the family time thing was going to be, you know, he's had health problems in the past. He had the heart attack during a season the 1 year. So I think I never thought Mark D'Antonio was going to be a guy that was hanging on until his 70s. I think at some point he was going to stop and then live, you know, the next part of his life with his wife and, you know, his family and everything else. And I think that that was going to happen. And I think that that was always going to be difficult for him. But I think, Bruce, you have a great point when you say that Chris Peterson maybe was running to something, whereas Mark D'Antonio looked like a guy who, it almost, guys, I mean, not to be like whatever, but it almost felt like a guy who'd been told, you know, like given a bad diagnosis or something, and was told you can't keep working and you have to, you know, this choice is not really in your hands anymore. And that's what it felt like. Because he was obviously emotional. You know, he's been frustrated, I think, with everything that's gone on. But I think the frustration is as much about everything that's happened off the field and the problems that that's caused for them as it is the losing on the field. I mean, they can't be separated. They go hand in hand. You know, and I said the other day, I was like, you know, in 2017, they had four players get charged with sexual assault. You don't survive that as a coach. I mean, you're not going to. And as long as, you know, this was not a sustainable situation, he coached a couple more years, and eventually all that stuff off the field, if there's more stuff coming out, you know, if your program's having problems, that stuff's going to come out. It's going to be a problem for you, and eventually it's going to end. And, you know, I don't think we can totally separate the two and say it was simply a wins and losses thing. I think there are other factors probably at play in that whole situation.
So when I look, I'm curious to get both your guys' opinions about this, and I'll set it up this way. I was just looking back at that. It's just an unbelievable run he had from 2010 to 2015. They won at least 11 games, five out of those six seasons. And to put that in perspective, they had never won 11 games in a season in the entire history of the program, and they'd only won 10 games twice. So, I mean, it's just astonishing what he did during that time. And obviously there was a playoff berth and Big Ten title, three Big Ten titles. But then when it got ugly, it got really ugly. 3-9, then the return to 10-3, 7-6, 7-6. And on top of that, all the things you're talking about, Nick, the sexual assault allegations against his players, and I would also just say the stubbornness, the refusal to change, to make any coaching changes. So I'm curious both your opinions on this. When we look back 10 years from now, how will the D'Antonio era be remembered? How much of it will be about all the success, how much will be about the way it ended?
I think that in 10 years, you know, again, I think that everyone's going to remember the top half of this decade, this last decade, the 2010 through 2015. Everyone at Michigan State's going to remember that fondly, and they're never going to forget that. I think he's always going to be remembered as the greatest, you know, sort of on-field coach they had in the modern era. You know, he was able to accomplish things at Michigan State that, you know, as someone who's grown up here, and I know you guys have followed college football forever too, we all thought there was no way Michigan State in a modern world was going to be a team or a program that could compete consistently like that for that many years. Like, you know, every couple years, yeah, sure. But from 2010 to 2015, they were one of the best programs in the country, and they were on a short list for sure. I mean, they were as good as anybody. Their defense was ridiculous. He was an outstanding football coach, especially defensively, and an outstanding talent evaluator and developer. But at the same time, you know, even 10 years from now, I just don't think you're going to be able to look back on it without remembering, you know, how it ended. Remembering the bad stuff, you know, that's happened off the field. I'm not sure if that's going to overwhelm the good stuff. I think in time, the good stuff will probably be the thing that people remember the most. But it's not, others aren't going to forget, you know, how it ended either. And I think that that's an important thing to note, is that they'll be tied together, and that'll all be packaged in with his legacy, you know, for the rest of time, probably.
Nick, let me ask you just to kind of follow up on Stu's question. Is how much do you think his legacy is a TBD in this, because of this ongoing Curtis Blackwell case against D'Antonio? And I mean, honestly, a lot of us outside of Michigan probably haven't followed it that closely. I mean, where do you think is going to happen out of that?
Well, I think that's the hanging thing, right? So it's, you know, if Curtis Blackwell has, you know, more information or allegations or claims of things that went awry or what have you that can be proven, and they're, you know, worse than what's already been thrown out there, you know, then that's going to obviously impact, you know, how people remember him. Because, I mean, if it gets worse, you know, because in some ways, I don't, you know, this probably isn't over. You know, that lawsuit's not over. They haven't settled it. Nobody settled it. They're still fighting it. You know, Michigan State has claimed that, you know, none of this is true. But, you know, I mean, that's stuff that if it continues to happen, I mean, you're going to have to find proof on that at some point. So I think it's all still sort of up in the air a little bit. I think in terms of football, obviously that legacy is done. But, you know, what happens from here, you know, I'm not real sure. And I think that that's something that will probably complicate the coaching search to a degree, and that, you know, how much, I don't know, but at least to a point where they're going to have to prove to, you know, be it Luke Fickell or any other candidate, that, you know, there's not some, you know, mountain of stuff sitting under a rug somewhere, and there's not a, you know, tornado about to happen around the corner. And, you know, that's not an easy conversation to have with someone who doesn't have to take your job. So, I mean, like, those are things they're still going to have to discuss. And for D'Antonio, that's still something that's going to hang over his head until, you know, we'll see how long.
So I'm interested, you know, you cover both Michigan and Michigan State, and obviously kind of the defining thing, I think, about D'Antonio's tenure is the dominance over Michigan, which they, that program had never done anything like that before, to win 7 of 8 against their rival. And then it just seemed like once Harbaugh got there and got settled, it flipped back. You know, we'll talk about specific candidates here in a second, but in general, whoever the next Michigan State coach is it possible for both those programs to be good at the same time? Or does Michigan State need, you know, during that time, you know, Brady Hoke was nobody would say he was a successful. Rich Rod first, then Brady Hoke. Is Michigan State's success in some ways tied to the relative stability going on or not going on at Michigan?
God, that's a great question, and it's one that we've like contemplated for years here. I used to always be of the mind that it wasn't possible that Michigan State, you know, both teams were not going to be able to, you know, be at a playoff level together. I didn't think that there was enough to go around in the Midwest. I still would probably, you know, lean on that stance. You know, I'm not sure if it works one way more than it works the other, but you know, I it's never happened. It's never been a thing ever. And as we sit today, you know, neither team is in position to be, you know, playoff worthy. But I just don't think that, you know, within the state of Michigan, obviously Michigan State recruits, Michigan barely recruits Ohio anymore, you know, under Harbaugh. They just don't do it. So, you know, with Ohio State being what it is, Notre Dame, Penn State, Michigan, and Michigan State, you know, within this, Michigan is the weakest, you know, sort of in-state talent base compared to Ohio, compared to Pennsylvania, compared to what Notre Dame can do nationally, of course. So within the state of Michigan, there's only so many prospects to go around. For a place like Michigan State, you're going to have to get super creative. And then for Michigan, too, you're going to have to get creative as well. So I would have to believe that, you know, to be true if we actually saw it happen. I mean, it's never, ever happened. You know, when Michigan State's been really good, Michigan State's had problems, or Michigan's had problems, and vice versa. You know, and maybe Michigan State's lack of success in the 80s and 90s and 70s could be tied to maybe Michigan a little bit. But, you know, I'm not sure going forward if that stays, you know, a two-way street, but it's never been done. And, you know, I'm not sure if that can happen. I think both teams could be Big Ten, you know, contenders if Ohio State wasn't, you know, rocking and rolling. But, you know, beyond that, I think that would be a stretch.
Nick, let's get a little bit to the coaching search. As we tape this Thursday morning, and it's obviously a very fluid situation, one of the favorites, it would appear, would be Cincinnati's Luke Fickell.
Yep.
He's done a really good job. He's obviously a lifelong Buckeye, coached and played there. And a lot of people who have kind of talked to him and talked to people close to him have said there's very few jobs that he sees as a real fit.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, he would not go to Michigan. Ohio State is obviously a dream job kind of place, but right now Ryan Day has got that job. Doesn't look like that job is going to be open anytime soon. I think Penn State would be one of those, but obviously James Franklin has that job. We don't know how messy he sees Michigan State. From my understanding, mm-hmm. Luke Fickell knows some of the challenges that and the limitations of being in the Group of Five.
Yep.
Even if you're at a place like Cincinnati where he has won 22 games the last 2 years, who would you, let's just put this aside, I want to throw some names at you, and I'm going to give you four names. So there's Luke Fickell, who obviously knows the Big Ten well and mm-hmm. is recruiting in that footprint where D'Antonio has had success.
Yep.
Then there's Robert Saleh, who's a Michigan native, done a really good job, has impressed a lot of people in the NFL world. There's now the defense coordinator with the Niners, and a lot of people think will be a head coach in the NFL in another year because they're loaded on that side of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Another name to consider, but I'm not sure if it's viable at this point, just in terms of the timing, is Broncos offensive coordinator Pat Shurmur,
who's
recently fired by the Giants. He just did a deal with the Broncos, but obviously has deep ties to Michigan State, having coached and played there. And then the last name to me is really a wild card, and that's Brett Bielema.
Mm.
Won 40 games in his last 4 years at Wisconsin. Big personality guy, knows the Big Ten. He is actually now with the Giants on their defensive staff. Who would you handicap and say, okay, this is the guy I think would give them the best chance to compete with Ohio State at the top of the division?
I think it would be, I mean, I think it's Fickell. I think that in some strange ways, And, you know, Bielema is an interesting one because it's been a minute and we forget maybe how good he was in the Big Ten because it had been a minute since he was in the Big Ten. Of course, he wasn't in the Big Ten East the way it sits today. Not to take anything away from him, but that's just the reality of the situation as this is one of the more difficult divisions in college football. But I would say Fickell because, you know, for a number of reasons. The thing that, you know, Stu had asked if Michigan and Michigan State can both be, you know, elite at the same time. And maybe that was how I read it in my own mind. I think that they both can be sort of competitive at the same time. And I think Fickell can get them to that situation because of his ability to recruit Ohio and sort of his ability to be a, you know, trestle ball type coach, which is essentially a guy that's, you know, a second version of D'Antonio 20 years younger. I mean, Luke Fickell's a defensive coach, maybe not as accomplished a defensive coach as Mark D'Antonio was when he got the job at Michigan State, but he's a defensive coach, pretty well respected in that area. He's a younger coach who understands that offenses have evolved and, you know, you've got to, you know, evolve with it. And then Luke Fickell has been for, you know, the better part of a decade here, you know, one of the best, you know, recruiters in the state of Ohio that exists. And, you know, if you're at Michigan State, they had major success. I mean, that is why Mark D'Antonio's success level skyrocketed the way it did, is he was able to go into those pockets of Ohio and find guys that other people weren't looking at and develop the heck out of them. And it's not a coincidence that Luke Fickell's arrival at Cincinnati, you know, came up the same time that Michigan State's roster started to downgrade a little bit. You know, Mark Stoops and Luke Fickell hurt Mark D'Antonio more than Michigan ever did on the recruiting trail by their ability to go into Ohio and sign kids that Ohio State wasn't going to take, you know, that Ohio State could have had but didn't want. And then you build your program off those kids, and it worked wonders for D'Antonio. It's worked for Stoops. It's worked for Fickell. I think Fickell checks probably every box Michigan State would want in a head coach. Bruce, right up until the point you said about the thing about Michigan, is that Luke, if the Michigan job were to come open and Luke Fickell was, you know, this hot name and Michigan would consider him, he doesn't want it, right? Because he doesn't like Michigan. And you, Michigan State's entire football program, you know, was centered around a hatred for Michigan and a lack of respect from Ann Arbor and everything else, and it worked. And so Michigan State will surely look to continue that. And Fickell, you know, as I see it today, there's not a box that he doesn't check. You know, Bielema would be the second most interesting person in that conversation. Narduzzi would have been, possibly. But, you know, I mean, obviously he says he's staying, and maybe that's... but I still think Fickell would have been a better situation, possibly a better candidate than even Narduzzi, who had been here because of his ability and proven ability to recruit in Ohio. And I think that's got to be number one on the list.
Yeah, I think I would agree exactly with Nick on those power rankings there. Bielema is intriguing in that he has had mm-hmm. success as a Big Ten head coach, but he was last in the Big Ten in 2012, so I'm not even yep. sure how relevant that would be now, and Fickell is obviously on the upward trend.
But in fairness, he has been a Big Ten head coach.
Oh, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm.
Luke Fickell's, you know, he's at Cincinnati, and he fixed what Tommy Tuberville had kind of sucked the life out of in Cincinnati, but it's... You know, again, one of the things, not to interrupt you too much on the Stu, but like, you know, Robert Saleh, we have no idea.
Yeah, that's
a tough
one.
Really well respected in the NFL, but that's a, you know, who knows with that one? It's just, I guess that speaks to the nature of it, where it's like, Bielema was the one guy we know has coached in the Big Ten, at least.
Yeah, I think it's those two, and I would feel good with either. Just slight edge to Fickell, just because of the, you know, both the on-field and the recruiting success right now. In that yeah. exact part of the country where he'll need to be successful at Michigan State. Nick, before we go, we wanted to ask you real quick about the Wolverines. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at their signing class this year, the overall rank, I mean, they're, you know, on 247, number two in the Big Ten, number yeah. 14 overall, nothing wrong with that. But then you look at the class itself, no top 100 players, you know, and only three in the top 200. I'm curious what the perspective is there on how Harbaugh's recruiting these days, because obviously when he first got there, that he made all these waves with the sleepover and the
yep.
satellite camps and all that, and it just seems like the last couple years, it's maybe quiet. You don't necessarily hear that buzz yeah. as much.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I mean, you guys know this, that when a coach takes over a program, of course, you know, a big name especially, you're going to get those 2 years or those two full cycles, the first two. And you're going to have the ability to sell, you know, that hope, and this is brand new, and you can be part of something different. And Michigan sold the heck out of that and, you know, had two outstanding classes in 16 and 17 on paper. 17 didn't work out as well as they would have liked. But when you get into year, my theory has always been you get to year three or four and you haven't delivered on any kind of championship, all of that new car smell goes away and everything gets more difficult. You know, they missed on so many guys in 2018 that I think it forced them to sort of reevaluate everything they do about recruiting. And they did a nice job, I thought, last year of getting back to being in that, you know, number 8 through 12, you know, area. I always call it no man's land because you're not in the playoff and you're not really bad, but you're just kind of there. And in today's football, it's just, what are you? So they're right in that spot. You know, they're recruiting well, like you said, like right around like kind of what Penn State's doing, but it's certainly not at Ohio State's level and it's really not close. And you can see when they go on the field, this is falling apart in terms of a rivalry. It's not a rivalry anymore in terms of a game. It's just a game that Ohio State decides it's going to care more about than the previous one. So they pound them, and the talent gap is just, it's just widening every year. And so it's just, they're stuck. They're in this weird, you know, weird space. And I would argue now they're actually sliding down, you know, no man's land, because Penn State, I think, was probably ahead of them this year. Wisconsin was ahead of them this year. They were at best, you know, Minnesota was ahead of them, I guess, this year. They were at best the fourth best team in the league. They underperformed. I think that's noticed by recruits as well. So, you know, I think that Jim Harbaugh will always be able to deliver Michigan a class that's, you know, number 9 through 13 or 14. And I think he'll always be able to develop it at a better rate than Brady Hoke did. But I still don't think that's at this point, as it's going right now, that's not enough to do or solve whatever's happening with Ohio State. So, you know, in a lot of ways, Michigan needs Ohio State to take a fall. They need Ohio State to stumble or trip or open the door or something, because, you know, I'm not sure what else they can do in the current situation, if everything continues the way it's been, to totally change that. You know, I mean, that's their reality, but they're not alone in that. There's a lot. Everyone else in the Big Ten right now is looking at that exact same situation, because Ohio State has just distanced itself so much to a point that, you know, we really have never seen it like that before.
Well, we thank Nick for coming on today. Plenty of other the Athletic, you know, obviously covering this story from all angles. But in terms of podcasts, you can get more of Nick on The Beat, the podcast he does with Brendan Quinn, and then of course for Michigan State specific, Green and White Noise with Chris Vanini and Colton Pouncey. So all over this story. Nick, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Absolutely, guys. Take care.
Before we get into signing day, Bruce, I should have said this right off the top, but you were literally the first person last summer on this podcast. I don't remember if it was maybe July, August. You said, I think Mark D'Antonio is going to retire after the season. And at that time, it was like, whoa, really? Like, what are you talking about? And then as the season went on, it seemed like, okay, this is definitely becoming a realistic possibility. So kudos to you for breaking that news, if you will.
Yeah, I don't know if it was breaking it, but it was, you know, like, it's going to be interesting to see him not be there, just because having done a lot of Michigan State games and been around there, you know, you don't really remember it much before he was there at this point, you know? I mean, I don't remember Bobby Williams and Saban. I mean, obviously I know they coached there.
Surely you remember John L. Smith.
Just from the halftime interview kind of clips. I don't remember, you know, I remember it being really inconsistent up and down, and Antonio brought consistency to that program and made it tough.
And he gave them an identity. You knew exactly what Michigan State was going to be for most of those years, but then unfortunately he didn't evolve. So
I don't know if it's that. I think from talking to people who are close to that program, to me the biggest issue was staffing issues came back to bite him. You know, he had Narduzzi was a great defensive coordinator, he moved on, but I think he struggled on with offense, he struggled moving some of the parts around, maybe he hung on to assistants. The analogy I would use a little bit was, it reminds me of what I heard about Syracuse under Paul Pasqualoni. Syracuse used to be really, really good. And then there were some of the staff issues came where maybe some of the assistant hires weren't as good. And he wasn't going to force guys out. He would just kind of try to coach around them as best he could. And eventually it caught up to him. And it feels like it did a little bit, as well as Nick said, you know, just the rest of the top of the division got so much better, especially in how it recruited.
And I also think one thing it doesn't get talked about is at all. I mean, we think of Michigan State, we think defense, but he had three NFL quarterbacks in a row: Brian Hoyer, Kirk Cousins, and then Connor Cook. And obviously, the guys after Connor Cook left just did not come close to that level. So yes, they needed probably a change in scheme and new minds on offense, but they also so much in college football today is tied to the quarterback, and they just really struggled at that position. Okay, turning our attention to signing day, I thought, you know, at this point, most of the kids signed in December, February signing day, pretty anticlimactic, but there actually were a couple notable developments, one being, most notably, Clemson had the number one class for an entire year and was assumed they would finish with the number one class. And then on the last day, Georgia got a couple big pickups, and Georgia finished as number one, consensus number one in recruiting, for the second time in 3 years. So Kirby Smart, having now signed the number one class two out of the last 3 years and a top three class four straight years, is it safe to say national championship or bust at this point when you have that kind of talent?
I feel like it was that going into 2020 season. Yeah. And look, some of these kids we're talking about now in this number one ranked class, you would expect them, you know, down the road, that's putting a lot on their plate. But just considering how much they have stockpiled with these high profile recruits, it's like, I don't know. If you're a Georgia fan, because I tweeted something out about where they were ranked, how many five stars they've signed in the last 4 years. And one of the dominant responses I got back was, how many championships do they have to show for it? And I don't know. I mean, honestly, there's a lot of pressure on Todd Monken to come in and fix a lot of problems, it feels like, the new offensive coordinator.
Well, I think that, first of all, they came as close as you possibly could to winning a national championship 2 years ago. And then the last couple seasons, they still finished top 10, you know, in the top 10 of the polls, number four this past year. But when you're signing classes this good every year, then 11-2 and going to the Sugar Bowl is considered disappointing.
You mentioned that, but they got whipped by Georgia last year. I'm sorry, they were whipped by Texas last year in the bowl game. They got, the last 2 years, LSU has beaten them by combined by 55 points or something. Like, they haven't even been close.
Yeah, they haven't been at that level. Obviously, much has been made of the struggles at quarterback last season, receiver. Look, I'm the first person to say, like, hey, rein in expectations. It's very, very hard to win a national championship in college football. It's probably not fair to judge a coach by whether he wins one or not. But at this point in time, okay, we're heading into a season in which LSU, I think we all agree, will take a step back. It may not be a huge step back, but there's no way they're going to play at the level they did last year, given losing not just Joe Burrow, but both, you know, Joe Brady and Dave Aranda and Grant Delpit and all these guys. And Alabama, I think, will be very good, but I don't necessarily think you look at Alabama, who they have coming back, and Georgia, who they have coming back, and say, oh yeah, Alabama's definitely better than Georgia. There's no reason at this point why they can't beat them, why they can't win the SEC. And of course, if they do that, they're going to be in the playoffs. So I think you said going into last season that it would be a disappointment. Considered a disappointment if Georgia didn't win a national title either last season or this coming season. Do you still feel that way?
I do, and I do for a lot of the reason you spelled out just a second ago, which was, you know, going, when I think I first said that, I didn't know, like, I knew LSU was going to get a lot better. I didn't know Joe Burrow would have the best season in the history of quarterbacks in college football, but I was pretty sure that Tua and a bunch of those receivers were leaving. So I looked at it as, look, Alabama is not going to be as good in 2020 without Tua and without Jerry Jeudy and some of those other guys. Now, they do have Dylan Moses coming back, and he didn't play this year, and certainly they kept some of their underclassmen. But just looking at it, I was like, all right, here's your window, the next 2 years. Not to say that – you know, if it's they don't do it this year, that you can't win a national title 6 or 7 years into your run as a head coach. But one of the things I feel like has happened, and there's exceptions to this, but it's like you kind of show what you are in the job within your first 4 or 5 years as a head coach. And after a while, it feels like you lose momentum. And one of the things I wonder about, and again, I think Todd Monken is a big key hire here to change the offense and maybe change the vibe around the program. But, you know, we know how buttoned up Kirby Smart is. The team that has played, and I use this example because I was at the SEC title game. The team that played LSU just was way tighter than the team that whipped them. And you know, the question is, can this team loosen up? And again, like you said, they were close to winning a national title a couple of years ago, but they weren't close the last 2 years. And they have a lot of high profile recruits, and it's just like, okay, I think this is a huge year for them, because I think it just gets harder when all of a sudden people, you know, everything around you is pushing in the other direction.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, USC, a program that almost annually has a class that is either number one or close to number one or certainly in the top five or top 10, finishes this cycle on 247, number 55 in the country, number 10 in the Pac-12, only ahead of Washington State and Arizona. It's very unusual, and I certainly understand why it's noteworthy, but I guess I'm surprised that people would be so surprised by this, given Clay Helton has been in limbo for 2 years now. Is it really any surprise that kids don't want to commit and sign to a program where they don't know who the head coach is going to be the next year?
No, I think that's it. Look, and to spin it forward, I would ask you, barring, and you, if you look at their schedule, so they open with Alabama. Everybody knows they'll be an underdog in that game. And then the next seven games aren't just winnable. They should be favored in all of them, and probably a bunch of them by double digits. And look, they still have a lot of players. Say what you want. I could see why a freshman quarterback would be leery of going there. Keaton Slovis is really good, and they still have JT Daniels, and they have a bunch of good receivers, and they still have some pieces now. I mean, I think they should be a 10-win team. The question I have, though, is if they play Alabama and it's not close, they could go win the next seven games before they go to Oregon at 7-1 going into November. But I think that Alabama game will be such a headliner, especially considering they got blown out by Iowa in the bowl game and the recruiting rankings we're talking about. I mean, you know, I don't want to say it's a must win, but it's in regard to like, what's the only way you can turn around the recruiting ranking so it's not going to be this way again or close to it in 2021? I mean, that's what I think they're staring at, is the horrible finish against Iowa, the horrible ranked recruiting class, and then you're going to open right out of the gate with this marquee game against Alabama. I mean, I don't, you know, look, if they're competitive and it's a tight game, and look, I think USC has enough players to make it that, then, you know what, we'll see what happens. But if it's not close, you're going to see more of this, and it's, again, it's going to be life on the hot seat for year three or year four or whatever it is.
Here's how messed up things are around USC right now. So I wrote, the lead of my mailbag on Wednesday was why I think USC could be a sleeper team in 2020 for all the reasons you said. And I fully acknowledged right off the top about the dysfunction at that place right now, but that you could be staring at a scenario where they still get crushed by Alabama, but they go on to win the Pac-12. Perfectly realistic to me. Now, when you write something like that, I can expect to get either, if I write something that's really glowing about a team, I might expect to get some hate tweets or some hate comments from their rival. And if I write something bad about a team, I might expect to get it from their own fans. What I've never seen before is that I wrote something nice about USC and got all these angry USC fans angry that I'm drinking the Clay Helton Kool-Aid, or that, like, they want him gone so bad that they don't even want anybody to suggest that he might be successful.
Well, that's where we're at. I mean, look, I think they want it over. They don't want anybody looking for silver linings. They're done, right? And so the question is there anything possible he could do to reverse that feeling? And the only thing possible is to beat Alabama and go on a roll where they get out of the gate 8-0. Because if not for that,
again, you know, look, we talked about the economics of what it would have taken to fire Clay Helton and turn the page on USC football. That wasn't happening. But now you're dealing with the reality, and that's kind of what you were writing into yesterday and why you got the reaction. There was a lot of frustrated USC fans, and unlike probably what the perception of other parts of the Pac-12 footprint, the USC has a big fan base, and it's just the one that's really pissed off right now.
I get it. I just don't know if they understand, like, the negativity, the massive negativity is certainly not helping him recruit. It's probably making it close to impossible. And I don't think people understand, like, okay, let's say you get your wish and Clay Helton gets fired after this year. The extent of these back-to-back or maybe even back-to-back-to-back disappointing classes, you know, you think going, if you're upset about going 8-5, I mean, it could get much worse once you're talking about a roster that is just not, that's not even that good. That you know, you could be, the next coach might have to deal with some losing seasons. I don't know. The whole way USC has handled this has been just ridiculous. As I pointed out in the mailbag, they've now fired pretty much everybody both above and below Clay Helton while keeping him, right? The president's gone. The AD's gone. Lynn Swann. Once Mike Bone came in, he fired some of Lynn Swann's top lieutenants. So cleaning house on that level. And then over the last two off seasons, Clay Helton has changed over almost his entire coaching staff. But he's still standing somehow, and that's why we are where we are. Anything else? You know, what interested you most about signing day?
Well, right now, maybe the most talented defensive lineman in the country, Jordan Burch. He grew up right near the University of South Carolina. He's a South Carolina kid. He's 6'6", 270. You know, pretty freaky athlete. There's been a weird bit of drama in what has been, for the most part, a drama-free late signing period other than him. So a month ago, or whatever it was, 6 weeks ago, he committed to South Carolina publicly on TV but didn't sign anything, and the word was because he wanted to do it with his teammates. Well, that opportunity was Wednesday, and he didn't do it. And our South Carolina reporter, Josh Kendall, did an interesting, you know, reached out to try to speak to him, and the mom said no interviews. And a few hours later, South Carolina, Will Muschamp, who was, by the way, and this is a, creates an added bit of awkward moment, Will Muschamp's son was a quarterback there, and he's now going to be a walk-on at Georgia, his dad's alma mater. Will Muschamp was there at that press conference where the biggest recruit Will Muschamp could have signed in the last 5 years is committed, yet hasn't signed anything. So what's going to happen? Is Jordan Burch actually going to end up at South Carolina? We'll see. It is very puzzling why he hasn't signed anything yet, though. And that's, you know, look, the other thing I would say with signing day, and I think this is something that we've learned in the last couple of years, not just with the early signing period, but more with the grad transfer element of it, is if your school missed out on a player, or they think they missed out or whatever, you know what? In some ways, they may be better off for it now, because this leaves a lot of schools with the opportunity for maybe two or maybe three or maybe four spots. And maybe there's some grad transfers who are out there now, but most likely there are grad transfers who could be out there, you know, into the spring. And I think that's when you may see guys, whether they're Power 5 players, Group of 5 players, or even FCS guys that some schools may pick up to fill out their roster and compete for starting jobs, where in reality some of those high school recruits may not have been in that position. And those guys often can be difference makers. I use the example of Cole Tracy, who is LSU's kicker, who came from Assumption, which is a, you know, like a Division III school, I think in Massachusetts. That kid was a difference maker for them. So keep an eye on who your school may pick up in the next, you know, next 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, you know, one of my observations is, do the recruiting sites need to, given how much a part of the sport the transfer portal is now, do the recruiting sites need to figure out a way to, I don't know if you would replace the rankings you do now, but maybe have separate rankings that take into account the fact that, okay, let's say a school only signs 15 kids to letter of intents, and that affects their recruiting ranking. But then they're adding three or four grad transfers, and some of them are really good. like, don't, if that's who the scholarships are going to, do we need to take that into account? For example, should Mississippi State get some sort of credit in its recruiting class for the fact that it is giving one of its scholarships to KJ Costello, a former all Pac-12 quarterback? Like, I don't know. I don't know what the right way to do that. Obviously,
well, that's all somebody who's more anyway. Because I brought this up to our friend Barton Simmons, who is the lead analyst that's at 247. And one of the things that you'd hear back is just, it's like how from a lot of people in the recruiting side of it on the online recruiting world is, how would you necessarily, like, what would Joe Burrow have been? Would he have been a three-star guy? Do you give him the same grade you did when he was coming out of high school, where one site had him a three-star, the other one had him as a four-star? There's certain guys who might have been five-stars who are now maybe three-star guys because they haven't proven to be that much. So I think that was one of the challenges. But I've argued this for a long time. I go back to my meat market days. You know, Ole Miss had to count on their internally Jevon Snead. He was a transfer from Texas. He would have been a big recruit for them. He was a huge recruit for Ole Miss. But that didn't count in the recruiting rankings online, but it certainly counts in the scholarships in terms of how you have to allocate it. So, again, I think this is all cosmetics. I'm not sure. You know, you and I spent a bunch of time talking about that Georgia was the number one ranked class. I really don't think it matters that much whether you're the number one class or you're the number five class. I really don't think it's, in the end of the day, it makes that big of a difference.
Well, if you look at the points on 247, there's not much of a gap between number one and number five. I'll tell you where there is a big gap. You look at, let's say, number eight, Florida. Just going by their points, right? Florida is actually closer to being number 16 than they are to being number four. So it's like, once you get to that point in the rankings, it's a big jumble. I think number one is mostly important symbolically, because if you look back at, and certainly our time covering the sport, the schools that got number one classes won national championships. Maybe not immediately, but there was a pretty big association. You know who I always think of when I think of what the situation Kirby Smart's in, getting back to what you said earlier about, you know, if you don't do it after a certain period of time, you know what you got. Well, Mack Brown, for the first, 7 years of his time at Texas, was known as pretty much that, Mr. February. He would sign these number one classes, or close to number one classes, every year. And they would get beaten by Oklahoma, and they would go to a nice bowl, but they wouldn't be in national championship contention after the Red River game. And then finally, gets Vince Young, and finally in 2005, they break through and win it. It can happen if you keep recruiting that level of talent.
Well, I think what's missing is Vince Young was a transformational college player. Georgia hasn't had that, right?
No, they have. I mean Justin Fields could have been that guy.
Yeah, they might have had it in Justin Fields. That's right. They might have had it in Justin Fields. But, you know, you and I had talked about this. I think we were a little more skeptical on the the early draft rankings and the hype around Jake Fromm. He was a good college quarterback, but I think the people talking about it as like top five pick, I think they were kind of overselling it. I just think that when you look at some of these, what it takes to take a program and get it over the hump, it takes somebody being Vince Young. It takes somebody being Joe Burrow. It takes that guy who just can put a program on his back. To some degree, a large degree, Jameis did that at Florida State. Florida State was another one that was like constantly... Absolutely. Winning recruiting, you know, signing day battles, but was sputtering at times when they probably shouldn't have. I mean, look, I think Deshaun was that guy at Clemson. They've had plenty of five-star guys. They may not have had the as many of them as some of these SEC heavyweights, but Deshaun was the guy who carried them over into the promised land. And I just think that's, you know, let's see if you know, maybe Jamie Newman will be that guy. I don't know. But to go full circle on from where we started.
We got to wrap here, but real quick, Justin Fields may be the perfect example of why, of the poster for what we were talking about how that should be part of the rankings. Last year in 2019, Ohio State had the number 14 class in the country, a relatively small class with 17 commitments. But Justin Fields was technically part of that class, and he was 1 year removed from being a five-star quarterback. And then, of course, he ended up being... I mean, if they hadn't gotten him, I don't think you would have seen them in the playoff last season. So yeah. There's got to be a way to factor that in.
You know where the Joe Burrow class was ranked when he signed?
with LSU. I remember he signed several months after signing day, but where were they?
Number 15.
Yeah, so like he couldn't have factored that in on signing day, but once they did get him, that would have been a trickier one though because he hadn't played. So when I was thinking, look, when you were saying like,
yeah, yeah.
No, when you were saying like, how do you rank them?
That is a question, yeah.
Yeah, well, in my mind, I was thinking, well, you would just do like with Max Olson's great, you know, article he does every year re-ranking the recruiting classes from 4 years ago. He just assigns a point value based on all conference starter, multi-year starter, whatever. And so like KJ Costello would be worth that. But how do you do that with somebody like Joe Burrow, who 3 years into his career hadn't played yet? That's a lot tougher. Justin Fields had played sparingly. I think you would just have to make a qualitative assessment on based on where he is to this point in his career. What do we see his potential as? And everybody would have undershot Joe Burrow, obviously. I'm guessing he would have been in that system. He would have been like a three-star. But that's fine. You know, guys can exceed expectations. I just think you got to get some sort of credit for that. We had so much to get to this week that we ran out of time for the mailbag. But we have some great mailbag questions sitting there. So I'll tell you what. Next week, barring some sort of D'Antonio-type bombshell next week, we will devote quite a bit of the podcast to your questions. So send them to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next week. If you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating if you could, too. It helps us get the word out. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can download their music on Spotify or Apple Music. Follow me on Twitter at SL Mandel. Follow Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, what are you waiting for? You can get 40% off an annual subscription by using this link, theathletic.com/theaudible. That's 40% off your subscription to The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.